WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Peter Moss about accompanying Major John Nagel in his efforts to defeat the Iraqi insurgency. Nagel is the operations officer of an 800-soldier infantry battalion in the Sunni Triangle. He wrote his dissertation on counterinsurgency and is now putting his theories to the test. Moss profiled the major in this week's New York Times Magazine cover story. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD from German pianist and free jazz pioneer Alexander von Schlippenbach. He helped establish the European school of improvised music in the 1960s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The former finance chief of Enron and his wife have reportedly reached a plea agreement with prosecutors. The Associated Press quoted sources as saying that Andrew and Lee Fastow are expected to enter their pleas in a federal court in Houston tomorrow. Lee Fastow, a former assistant treasurer at Enron, is expected to plead guilty to a tax charge after her husband enters a guilty plea that could result in a 10-year prison sentence. The couple was reportedly holding out for a deal that would leave one of them free to take care of their two children. Prosecutors have been hoping that the bargain would induce the Fastows to cooperate in the investigation of senior executives at the bankrupt energy company, including Enron president Ken Lay. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that police do not violate motorists' constitutional rights when they briefly stop drivers at roadblocks seeking information about a crime. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
A week after a hit-and-run death in Lombard, Illinois, police set up a roadblock at the same time and location. They stopped each vehicle for 10 to 15 seconds to ask occupants if they'd seen anything the previous weekend, and they handed out flyers seeking information. When one of the motorists swerved to a stop, nearly hitting police, he was given a sobriety test and arrested for drunk driving. The Illinois Supreme Court, however, threw out the conviction on the grounds that the checkpoint was illegal under a U.S. Supreme Court decision that held drug checkpoints generally violate the Constitution's ban on police stops without individualized suspicion. Today, though, the High Court said that ruling is irrelevant to checkpoints set up to seek information about a serious crime where the motorists themselves are not suspects and the intrusion is minimal. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush has declared federal disaster status in two California counties rocked by last month's 6.5 magnitude earthquake. Tamara Keith reports from member station KQED.
The president's action frees up federal emergency funds to help recovery efforts in the coastal counties of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo. Both counties will receive assistance in repairing or replacing public facilities damaged by the quake. In San Luis Obispo County, aid will be available to residents and business owners who suffered losses. Ron Alsop is with the county's Office of Emergency Services.
Without it, we basically didn't have any disaster assistance programs to offer our citizens, or at least any financial disaster assistance programs. So this federal declaration will open up quite a number of programs that can assist those that were affected by the earthquake.
In San Luis Obispo County, officials estimate damage totals will reach $250 million. For NPR News, I'm Tamara Keith in San Luis Obispo.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow lost 58 points to close at 10,427. The Nasdaq lost 15 to close at 2,096. This is NPR News. In South Dakota, a judge has refused to dismiss the second-degree manslaughter conviction of Congressman Bill Janklow. Last month, the jury found the former four-term governor guilty of killing a motorcyclist in a traffic collision. Kurt Nikic reports from South Dakota Public Radio.
In a court hearing in the congressman's hometown, Janklow's lawyer asked the judge to throw out the felony conviction. He argued that prosecutors never showed that the congressman knew he was running a stop sign when he sped through an intersection and collided with a motorcycle, and therefore Janklow never consciously put other people at risk. But the judge said he would not overturn the guilty verdict, saying it was not unreasonable for the jury to convict the state's only congressman. Now Janklow is asking for a new trial. If that motion is rejected as well, he can then appeal his case to the South Dakota Supreme Court. He's scheduled to be sentenced on the manslaughter conviction next week. The 64-year-old Republican lawmaker could get up to 10 years in prison. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
So far, two people at least are confirmed dead after a tanker truck filled with flammable material apparently ran off an overpass and fell 40 feet onto Interstate 95 in Maryland. According to an eyewitness identified only as Bill, the truck exploded in flames.
When the tanker hit, it looked like a mushroom cloud just billowing into the sky. We saw the initial explosion. We didn't see it go off. We were standing around talking with some people who were actually coming up and basically saw it go off and stop and back up.
Police say other vehicles crashed into the fallen tanker. I-95 remains closed. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Peter Moss, spent last month in Iraq observing Major John Nagle on his mission, which is to defeat the Iraqi insurgency. Moss's profile of Nagle, called The Counterinsurgent, is the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. It's one of several reports from Iraq that Moss has written for the magazine. He's a contributing writer. Nagle is the operations officer of Task 134 Armor, an 800-soldier battalion that's part of the 1st Infantry Division. They're stationed in Camp Manhattan, 90 miles west of Baghdad, near Fallujah, in an area of intense anti-American activity. Major Nagle is a West Point graduate and Rhodes Scholar who commanded a tank platoon during the 1991 Gulf War. He studied counterinsurgency and wrote his doctoral dissertation on the counterinsurgency lessons from Malaya and Vietnam. I asked Moss if Major Nagle's scholarly research led him to adopt a philosophy of how to fight an insurgency.
He pretty much is a follower of the notion of total war, which, although it sounds like a phrase that means a scorched earth policy and often is interpreted as that, actually what it means is that you don't just fight the war militarily in a unidimensional fashion, but you also fight it in an economic fashion, you also fight it in a political fashion, you also fight it in a propaganda fashion. That is, on all fronts, you use all levers of national power, and that's not just military power. And that's what he and pretty much the other American commanders in Iraq are trying to do, fight a total war.
What are some of the biggest victories the insurgents have scored in the area that Nagle is in?
By far the biggest victory, in a sense, is the victory for hearts and minds. That is to say that militarily they haven't defeated the Americans, and that's not even their goal. No insurgency really tries to defeat militarily the occupier. What they try to do is make it impossible for the occupier to rule. One of the ways that they accomplish this is by instilling fear in the population of the occupier, and by also instilling a certain amount of hostility amongst the population towards the occupier, so that the occupation becomes difficult, if not impossible, to carry out. And that the insurgency has definitely succeeded to do, I think, to a great extent, though not entirely, in the region that Nagle operates in. There is a large amount of hostility, silent opposition. It's still unusual to see a lot of very large demonstrations of support for the Americans in this hostile area that Nagle operates in.
You write that a counterinsurgency needs to form local security forces. What are some of the reasons why that is so important, some of the reasons that Major Nagle passed on to you?
It's important because it's really only the local forces that can really get a handle on an insurgency and extinguish it. Because foreign forces, particularly the Americans now in Iraq, they don't speak the language by and large. They don't understand the culture by and large. They don't understand body language. They don't understand facial expressions in the way that locals do. They can look at somebody and know whether that guy belongs there, whether that guy is kind of acting shifty or not. And so for that reason, you need to have these local forces be the ones who are carrying out the counterinsurgency operations, who are identifying the people who are the bad guys, finding them and getting them. And they're more successful at that generally because they can get that information much more easily from the local population because they are part of the local population. And the Americans, particularly in Iraq, are very definitely not part of the local population. They are garrisoned at these incredibly well-defended bases. And when they go out, they're going out in convoys that consist of a number of military vehicles. And they don't mix with civilians in a way that tends to generate a large amount of contact and goodwill.
The Major gave you a very basic example of the problem that the U.S. would face, even if somebody, even if a local person came up to them and said, I know who one of the insurgents is, he lives in a certain house. What are some of the problems that the U.S. military would have actually getting this guy after he was informed on?
Well, they do have a lot of informers coming to them, offering them information, sometimes good, sometimes bad. But even when the information is good, it can be very difficult to act upon. For example, and this happens quite frequently with Noggle, he'll have an informer come to the entrance to the base or go up to a checkpoint that soldiers of his have somewhere. And they'll say, okay, there's a bad guy who's in my village and who's been firing mortars at you and planting IEDs. And, you know, Noggle will talk with this informer and say, great, great, fantastic. Okay, so where does this bad guy live? And the problem is that in Iraqi villages, streets don't have names, houses don't have numbers, and all the houses on each street look pretty much the same. So the informant can't give you an address that you can go to. The next question then is, okay, well, how do you figure out where this place is? Well, you can offer the informant, and this Noggle does all the time, maps, including overhead satellite imagery of the village or even the streets that this bad guy is living on. But the problem is that in Iraq, being a very secretive country, there haven't been a lot of maps. People aren't really as familiar with reading and understanding maps as they might be, let's say, in America. So it does no good to show a map or an overhead satellite imagery to a local informant. Then the next problem is, okay, well, you've got to take the guy to the street or close to the street so he can physically point out the house where this bad guy lives. But then you have another problem, and that is, well, you know, you offer the guy a ride to the neighborhood in the Humvee, but the informant obviously doesn't want to get into the Humvee because then all of his neighbors will see him in the Humvee and say, oh, he's a collaborator, and the guy will wake up dead the next morning. So even when you're presented with a guy who's got good information and wants to give it to you, actually kind of pinning it down and then acting upon it is a very, very difficult chore that Noggle, even with the extreme amount of study that he had made in the field of counterinsurgency before going to Iraq, really wasn't prepared for and didn't expect.
Okay, so that's one simple example of why you really need a local security force in addition to, say, the American military. What are some of the problems the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps has been running into so far?
Well, the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps is one of the main new security forces that the Americans are creating in Iraq. And these tend to be kind of local villagers who are put through 2 weeks of training and then given checkpoint patrols and things of that sort to do either on their own or with the Americans. But the problem, and I attended some training courses for ICDC personnel, is that the training is just 2 weeks long. You know, you can't make a soldier in 2 weeks. You can't really make a soldier in 2 months. And part of the instruction is just classroom instruction in English so that the ICDC personnel can understand the commands that the Americans that they're working with are giving them. And the result of this is that the ICDC is not coming along as quickly as the Americans hoped or would have liked in the form of becoming a force that can do independent operations that are aggressive and that really get at the root of the insurgency. It usually takes years, and this is a result of the American experience in Vietnam as well as El Salvador and other places. It usually takes years, actually, to develop and train a good indigenous force that does kill but doesn't kill indiscriminately.
Are most of the people in this force people who have experience in police or military work?
A lot of them have been in the military previously, so, you know, they fired AK-47s before and things of that sort. And that's very useful to the Americans, so you don't have to teach them all of the basics. But military training in Iraq, you know, wasn't terribly great. Iraqis, when they do, you know, even the insurgents, when they're firing at the Americans, they are very bad shots, which has actually saved a lot of American lives because they get shot at, but they don't get hit. So just because somebody has military experience doesn't mean that he's a good soldier and that just with a quick refresher course, he's going to become that again or become it for the first time.
What are some of the other problems that the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps is running into, including the problems of gaining the trust of the people they're policing?
Well, with a lot of these guys who are in the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, they're facing threats and harassment from the local population, even from members of their own family. When I was at this training course, the American commander said, yeah, you know, these guys have been threatened with death by relatives because they're working with us. That problem is beginning to go away somewhat, but it still exists. So this is something that really kind of, you know, hinders the enthusiasm or morale or willingness of ICDC soldiers to go out on aggressive operations because they don't want to piss off more people than those who are already angry at them.
Is Major Nagel worried about where the loyalty of the new recruits on the ICDC really lies? I mean, during an insurgency, it's very possible that men who will volunteer for a new police force will actually use the weapons to turn them against, in this case, the Americans and the Democratic leaders, when, if and when there are.
Right. Well, Nagel, actually, his battalion doesn't yet work with ICDC. So his familiarity with it and his views on it are somewhat distant since he's not yet working with it. He knows it very well and what the problems are. But in general, this is an issue. You know, if you're an insurgency, one of the things that you want to do, indeed, is to infiltrate the enemy. This is a matter of intelligence, and this is also a matter of crippling the enemy. And in this one base where I went to where they were training ICDC, in the very first class they had, there was a guy who was in the class who was trying to get the other members of the class to use all of the information that they were getting, as well as the weapons that they were going to be getting from the Americans, to launch attacks against the Americans. And this guy was found out. He was turned in by other members of the class, and he's now in prison. But you also had, as well in that first class, the first two commanders of the ICDC had to be fired because they were extorting kickbacks from all the recruits. They get paid about $60 a month. And the commanders were saying, okay, you got to give us, you know, 25 or 50% of that because we're the ones who are allowing you to get in the class.
My guest is journalist Peter Moss. His article, The Counterinsurgent, A Profile of Major John Nagel, is the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Peter Moss, and he's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, the Sunday Magazine. And this week he had the cover story called The Counterinsurgent about Major John Nagel, who is based in the Sunni Triangle and is leading one of the leaders of the counterinsurgency there. One of the things that Major Nagel believes is very important is, you know, winning the support of the people in Iraq. What are some of his tools to accomplish that? What are some of the things he is trying to do to get the support of the people in the Sunni Triangle where he's based?
He's trying to win their hearts and minds by getting them to focus on the future in the sense of, you know, look, do you want to have security? Do you want to have jobs for your family? If you do, we, the Americans, can and will provide that to you. We're doing it now because they're involved, the American military, in his region, as in every other region, in doling out money to health clinics, to schools, to hospitals, things of that sort. It's, in a typical day for Nagel, he'll maybe do a raid or two. And then, somewhat paradoxically, he'll also perhaps on the way back stop off at a school, check it out, and see if they need something, and then try to get them whatever it is they need. And so these are kind of the tools that he uses. It's, you know, economic incentives, basically, to get people over to his side.
Did you accompany him on meetings with local leaders?
Sure. There were a number of meetings that he had with, you know, local contractors, with local sheikhs who come to the gate of the base, and you know, they have their tea, and you know, the ones that he knows, he kisses them on the cheek and things of that sort. He's a fairly culturally aware individual, much more so obviously than the average enlisted soldier. And there was one meeting that I attended with him, which was actually with a local contractor who was doing some refurbishing of the buildings on the base. And as we were just kind of walking around inspecting the work that was being done, Noggle pointed to this worker who was on the roof of the building painting the roof of it. And you know, he said to me, the counterinsurgency aspect of the work that's being done just on this base is that guy up there who's painting the roof of that building isn't out planting IEDs trying to kill my soldiers. And, you know, Noggle said, what we need here is a WPA, you know, which was obviously the work's job creation program during the Depression in America. The problem that he has in terms of trying to, with these sorts of economic incentives, win over the population is that he doesn't have enough money. Even though there's been billions appropriated by Congress, actually getting it down to the grassroots where it's needed has not happened as quickly as it should. One morning I was having breakfast with Noggle in the canteen, and I asked him about the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, which is officially in charge of reconstruction and political development in Iraq. And he had a hard time almost containing his anger. There was an empty seat at the table, and he pointed at the seat, and he said, you know, where is the guy from the CPA? He should be sitting right there in that seat. You know, I have never seen at this base anybody from the CPA. And this is a very crucial area. This is the heart of the Sunni Triangle. He's responsible for Qaldiyya, which is, let's say, one of the top, you know, five, maybe one of the top five, perhaps one of the top 10 towns in terms of trouble that it's causing for the Americans. And nobody from the CPA has yet sat down with Noggle, who's third in command of the battalion, to ask him what he needs.
What's his interpretation of that? Does he think the CPA is understaffed or apathetic about this?
Well, it's not understaffed. I mean, I've visited the CPA headquarters in Baghdad, and there's no shortage of you know, men in khakis, dockers perhaps, or Gap, you know, clothes, you know, nice yuppies from Washington, running around there looking fairly busy, making calls back to Washington or trying to make calls back to Washington because communications still aren't terribly good. There are a lot of these guys there, a lot of these women there. The problem is that they're not getting out, you know, because of security concerns. They spend most of their time hunkered down in the Republican Palace in the center of Baghdad. They don't get outside the gates of the Republican Palace often enough. When they do go outside the gates of the Republican Palace, they usually are escorted by, you know, a Humvee or two or some civilian guards with Kalashnikovs or Uzis or M16s. This does not really kind of engender a great amount of communication, open communication and relaxed communication with whatever locals they might be visiting. On top of which, a lot of these civilians who are there on, you know, 90-day contracts, and it takes them 30 days to just kind of figure out, you know, which direction is north, which direction is south. And even people in the CPA, you know, acknowledge these problems and say, yeah, it's a very serious problem. One day I visited the CPA, and the person I was visiting had to come out to the gate to meet me. This is the new security rules there. And so he picked me up at the gate in his SUV, and we drove to the Republican Palace and had lunch there. And then I had to go back to the parking lot to get back into his SUV. And it was a large parking lot filled with nothing but SUVs. And he couldn't even find his SUV. We had to kind of wander through the parking lot with him with the little key alarm, clicking it on and off, you know, waiting for the horn of his SUV to beep. And it was a very interesting kind of a humorous metaphor. You know, this gentleman, who's a very smart guy, you know, was wandering around this parking lot trying to find his SUV. And so it made me kind of wonder, and him too, you know, how is he going to do once he gets outside of the gates of this place?
Right. How often have Major Noggle's men been directly attacked by insurgents in Iraq?
All the time. You know, basically every day there's an attack or two or three. He's lost. His battalion has had six soldiers killed and more than 40 injured. That's a battalion with a strength of about 800. All the time. I was with him on a number of patrols and occasions where we came under attack, where they had to fire back. The gunners and the Humvees fired back at crowds because they were hostile to us. At all times, whenever you leave the gates of the base, you know, your stomach automatically clenches because there's just this ever-present threat, particularly of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, which are these bombs that the insurgents plant by the sides of roads and detonate them when the American vehicles go by. And this happens frequently, and it's the cause of greatest concern for the American soldiers, more so than an ambush, because the Iraqis, the insurgents, actually, you know, they're not good shots. But these IEDs, these are quite deadly. They're very large explosives. A lot of American vehicles have been hit by them.
Major Nagles studied insurgency and counterinsurgency. He studied the war in Vietnam. He has very strong views about how a counterinsurgency should be waged. Does he feel like he's able to actually follow those lessons, or does he ever feel like the reality of what he faces forces him to violate his own rules and to violate the lessons that he learned?
He thinks that he's doing as good of a job as he can do, given the difficulty of counterinsurgency, given the limitations that exist upon him. He's number three in command of the battalion, not number one. The soldiers under his command are, by and large, 18-year-old kids who have never been outside of America before and don't speak a word of Arabic. He actually thinks that he's winning the war, or not that he personally is winning the war, but that they're doing a pretty good job, that they're making a lot of mistakes, and that that's making their lives more difficult in terms of making the progress that they would like to see. So he thinks it's a kind of, might seem to be a strange contrast, but he sees the mistakes that are being made. He tries not to make them. There was one day when there was this very big raid that that we went out on, and it was kind of a slight fiasco because it involved a very large number of very large vehicles, including tanks. And tanks are pretty much the worst vehicles to use when you're trying to do a surreptitious raid. And I asked him, and also the target that they were going after, a high-value target, they knew actually was not in the village that they were raiding. But since they had planned this raid, they decided just, well, we'll go ahead with it anyways. Who knows what'll turn up? And when I asked him about that particular raid beforehand, I said, well, why are you doing this? You know that this is, you know, not going to be successful, and it's just a brute use of force that was the kind that textbooks tell you shouldn't be doing. And he just kind of, he looked at me and he just pointed to his major's stripes on his shoulder and just said, you know, this is all I got. You know, so he can't do everything that he wants to do. Mm-hmm. But even within those limitations, he thinks that he's making more progress than lack of progress, that it's three steps forward, two steps back.
Peter Moss, his profile of Major John Nagle is the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. Moss will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by TIAA Cref, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Peter Moss about fighting the insurgency in Iraq. And Kevin Whitehead reviews Broom Riding, the new CD by European free jazz pioneer Alexander von Schlippenbach. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Peter Moss. He's covered several wars, including Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Last month, he was in the Sunni Triangle, a focal point of anti-American activity, observing Major John Noggle, whose mission is to defeat the insurgency. Major Noggle is the operations officer of an 800-soldier infantry platoon 90 miles west of Baghdad, near Fallujah. You were with Major Noggle in a convoy that could have been sitting ducks at some point. Could you describe what the mission was and what happened?
Well, the mission was actually, ironically, to just go to another base for a memorial service for a soldier who had been killed a couple of days previous by an IED. And we had to drive through Ramadi to get there. And the drive-through was okay. There's a mile-long stretch where traffic is always quite intense, and you are sitting ducks as you drive through. On the way there, it wasn't a problem. On the way back, it became quite a problem because two lanes of traffic were shut down. So instead of the usual four lanes, there were only two lanes available, became immediately gridlocked. And then there was actually a demonstration that nobody was aware of that began at a mosque at the end of the road, and a crowd of about 1,000 people started marching towards us. And this was the day after Saddam was captured, and the demonstration was against the capture of Saddam. It was pro-Saddam. It was anti-U.S. And the mob, well, it was a crowd initially, but then when they saw us, they kind of became a mob. They were all firing their weapons into the air. There was gunfire all around us. And then in an effort to get out of town as quickly as possible, the vehicles in the convoy, and there were just five Humvees, tried to jump this very large median. And one of the vehicles got stuck, so the convoy...
This median was about 2 feet high.
It was about 2 feet high. And, you know, Humvees have extremely high clearance, and they can jump over, you know, quite large medians, and that's what they're made for, to be able to take all kinds of terrain. This median was extraordinarily, unusually high, and indeed the commander, the convoy commander's Humvee, got stuck, so we couldn't leave. So they had to kind of stop, set up a perimeter there. The crowd surrounded us. They're firing their weapons in the air. They're shouting at us. They're waving the soles of their shoes at us. They're spitting at us. The American soldiers are pointing their weapons at the crowd, scanning the rooftops, gunfire all around. In the midst of which, Noggle turns to me and says, "Peter, have you ever seen Black Hawk Down?"
Was that his sense of humor? I mean,
he's got a very good sense of humor, and it's a very useful and necessary resource, I think, for anybody who's in a war zone, which might sound kind of paradoxical, but things are so heavy and so serious and so intense there that you need to somehow get away from it. And one of the ways you get away from it is by just making jokes about it and trying to see the lighter side, if there is a lighter side to be seen. And Noggle is quite good at that. And that perhaps is one of the reasons why he's a very good officer.
And where are you at this point? You're in a tank? You're in a Humvee?
No, well, we got stuck in the traffic and then tried to jump the median, and then had to, when the one vehicle got stuck, we had to stop try to get it out. And so I got out of the Humvee, as did all the soldiers, because you don't want to be stuck in a Humvee when the shooting starts, because the Humvee is a sitting target. The Humvee that I was traveling in, which was the major's Humvee, was not even armored. So I was outside of the Humvee, just kind of staying a few feet away from it, near the major. Nobody was walking any distance away from the Humvees, because there were so few soldiers on the ground that nobody wanted to get spread out, and they kind of formed a very tight perimeter.
To have the story end?
Well, after about 5 or 10 minutes, you know, that seemed like 5 or 10 years, the Humvee that was marooned actually was unmarooned. And so we were able then to drive away. But there was the crowd still kind of on the sides of the street, shouting at us, throwing rocks at us, and shooting at us. And so as we left town, the Humvee right behind us, which had a 50 caliber machine gun at the top, opened fire on some people who the gunner thought were firing at us. We then kept going down the road back towards the base, and all along the route, there were people, you know, shouting and jeering and throwing rocks and things of that sort. And we got to Chaldea, and somebody threw a smoke bomb in the road in front of us, and more rocks were thrown at us. And it was a very tense moment when Noggle's driver, who was steering the vehicle, the Humvee, with his left hand and cradling his M16, which was pointed out his window, with his right hand, was very close to taking a shot at some of the people who were throwing rocks at us, many of whom were kids. And so Noggle just leaned over to him and shouted, don't shoot the kids. He didn't, and we got out, but the Humvee behind us did indeed fire some shots. Don't know what happened in terms of casualties.
What are some of the lessons about the difficulty of this counterinsurgency, the lessons that you can take just from this one incident alone?
From that incident, when we were sitting ducks with the crowd around us in Ramadi, it was quite interesting that they did not shoot at us when we were the sitting ducks. They did, apparently, some people shoot at us as we were leaving. One of the reasons they didn't shoot at us is because anybody in that crowd who was an insurgent who wanted to take out some Americans would have known, by virtue of experience, the Americans now being an occupying power for, 7 or 8 months, that if you fire at the Americans, if you even begin to raise a weapon in the direction of the Americans, they will fire on you and they will kill you, because their fire is very precise. Now, that's very good for the Americans, because it means that people are scared of them, and people aren't going to try to take them out without thinking twice about it. The bad side of that is that because the Americans have used lethal force on a number of occasions, and sometimes the lethal force has not been exact, because the Americans have pointed their weapons at civilians and knocked down their doors and things of that sort, they have not won as many hearts and minds as they would like. So their tactics, on the one hand, make the Americans safer to a certain degree, perhaps because people do think twice before shooting at them, but it detracts from the American goal of winning over the hearts and minds of the people. And this is the crux of any counterinsurgency. You want to, and you need to, kind of finely, exquisitely calibrate the amount of force, whether it's lethal or otherwise, that you use. Because all of the kind of texts and all of the experience of counterinsurgency show that you do need to kill and capture and intimidate the enemy. That's just an absolute necessity. But you also need to win over to your side the general population, because that's, in a way, the battleground. It's not getting the guy with the gun, although you need to do that. You need to get the guy who doesn't have the gun, because the insurgents need that guy to provide him with food, with money, with hiding places, whatever. And you need to get that guy to not provide those things to the insurgents, and in fact to tell you where the insurgents are and who they are.
Here's one of the things I was thinking as you were describing the scene when the convoy was finally pulling out. And you know, there was a mob, and in the mob, you know, among the people were kids who were throwing rocks at the convoy. And you had the colonel who has his gun trained on the crowd, and the major saying, don't shoot the kids. Well, what happens when one of the kids is shot? If that happened, then the American military starts to look really bad. They're shooting at kids. And it's easy for the population to really turn against the occupying force when something like that happens. I mean, do you fear, just does Major Noggle fear, that a mistake like that is almost inevitable and that the consequences will be horrible?
It's not simply inevitable. It's happened. We're not talking about a future possibility that is nearly certain. There have been civilians, including children, who have been killed in bomb attacks and who have been shot by American soldiers. When you fire a 50 caliber machine gun at somebody, even if you hit the target, that bullet keeps going. The stopping power of a 50 caliber bullet is not just one human body. It goes through several rows of people. So this is something that happens. And the problem is that the cost of killing a civilian or injuring a civilian, particularly if it's a child, particularly if it's a woman, is geometric. It's not just, we killed this child or this woman, and the husband or the father or the mother is upset and becomes somebody who's now willing to support the insurgency. It's a very large number of people, probably not just even locally in that village, but if it gets onto Al Jazeera or some any television network broadcast even more widely, then it hits the general population and turns them against you. So, there was, during the Vietnam War, there was a famous American Colonel John Paul Vaughn, who was kind of a military dissident and a very tragic figure. And early in the war, he could see the problems that the Americans were creating in Vietnam by using indiscriminate firepower that killed civilians. And he told, in particular, David Halberstam, who was then a young reporter for the New York Times, he told him in a conversation in Saigon, "The weapon that we need to use in this war is a knife. We can't use bombs. We can't use artillery. And rifles really aren't even the proper weapon for this war. We need to use a knife because what we really need to do is know who we are killing. We have to kill the right people. We can't kill the wrong people because the cost of killing the wrong people is extraordinary." And that was one of the things that obviously made the American experience in Vietnam a failure. Nagle and other American officers are very acutely aware of that. He knows very well the cost of shooting kids. That's why he shouted at his driver, "Don't shoot kids." But he also knows, and this is what makes counterinsurgency so devilishly hard, just how difficult it is to shoot only the right people, or to point your weapons only at the right people, or to break down only the right doors. It's a task that may not even be possible.
My guest is journalist Peter Moss. His article, "The Counterinsurgent, A Profile of Major John Nagle," is the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Moss, and he's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, the Sunday Magazine. He has the cover story this week, which is called "The Counterinsurgent," and it's about Major John Nagle, who is working in the Sunni Triangle in Iraq. We know you end your article by writing, "No army has achieved a successful counterinsurgency that does not drag on for years and does not involve a large amount of killing." Did you say that to the major and say, what makes you think this one's going to be different?
Oh, I did. We had long talks about this. He thinks that it's going to be different because the Americans have learned from their mistakes and the mistakes of others. He also thinks it will be different, and this is an important consideration, because the insurgency in Iraq is not necessarily a popular insurgency. It's largely a Sunni insurgency. The Shias don't seem to support it. The Kurds certainly don't support it. And even amongst the Sunni population, it's not absolute support, because one of the hindrances of the insurgency is that it doesn't seem to have much of a view of the future of Iraq that is a positive view. I mean, okay, it wants the Americans out. What does it want in their place? what can it do better than the Americans or what the Americans want to leave in their place? And he sees that as a major benefit for the occupying forces, because their enemy doesn't have, you know, as, for example, the Viet Cong did in Vietnam, a general political strategy that offered a vision of the future that was, at the time at least, more attractive than what the prevailing option was.
I don't know if you saw it, but on Thursday of this past week, Tom Ricks, the Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, had an article about the Marines' approach to dealing with the insurgency as compared to the Army approach. And Major Nagle, who we've been talking about, is Army. Ricks writes, as the Marine Corps prepares to take over occupying much of western Iraq from the U.S. Army, it's planning a fresh approach that emphasizes restraint in the use of force, cultural sensitivity, and a public message that the new troops aren't from the Army, according to an internal Marine document and interviews with top officers. And Ricks goes on to quote a Marine officer who speaks on the condition of anonymity, who says, I'm appalled at the current heavy-handed use of airstrikes and artillery in Iraq. Success in a counterinsurgency environment is based on winning popular support, not blowing up people's houses. And the blowing of people's houses is a reference to the fact that the Army has punished some insurgents by blowing up their family's house. Any comments on the Marine versus the Army approach to dealing with the insurgency?
Sure. Well, you know, among other tactics that the Army has been using, also on a couple of occasions, they've surrounded villages with barbed wire. They've been taking into custody relatives of people whom they're looking for. They've been using aerial attacks against insurgent targets. Aerial attacks aren't quite as precise as using, as Colonel Vaughn in Vietnam suggested, a knife. The Marines, the tactics that they are proposing are indeed of a softer nature, part of which involves even kind of less force protection. That is, one of the suggestions that the Marines are looking at and hoping to do is to have more of their soldiers kind of based in towns and villages, obviously a little bit more vulnerable because they wouldn't have the same level of protection that they have at these big garrisoned bases. It's a different approach. The Marines historically are better and have more experience at counterinsurgency than the Army does because it's the Marines, you know, who are the first ones sent to land and foreign shores. And in 1940, the Marines published this study called the Marine Small War Manual, which is a classic of counterinsurgency, and it's a text that's as valuable today as it was when it was first published. So they have a lot of experience. The question is, and I talked with Nagle about this, I said, well, what do you think about this strategy that the Marines are thinking of using? And, you know, he just kind of shrugged, and his attitude was, you know, well, wait till they get here. The Marines have not actually been based. When they were part of the invasion force and afterwards, no Marine battalion was based in the Sunni Triangle. So the tactics that the Marines found successful in the non-Sunni areas that they were occupying after the invasion, those tactics were used in a population that was much friendlier, less hostile towards them than the population that the Army is encountering in the Sunni Triangle. It's probably worth trying a slightly different approach, you know, to the extent that even the Marines are saying we're not going to let our Marines wear sunglasses because that kind of alienates people. Things like that, sure, they should be used. And you know, maybe indeed they will be more successful. But one of the problems that happens in any military conflict, whether it's a guerrilla war or a conventional war, is that you can have certain plans and you can have certain ways that you want your soldiers to react, particularly in a kind, gentle way. But once you start taking casualties, once your soldiers or your Marines start getting shot at, once they start getting injured, once they start getting killed, there's just a psychological process that begins amongst the survivors of becoming much more hard-nosed. And that's one of the key problems of being kind and gentle. Maybe it can't last very long once actually there are casualties, and there will be.
You wrote an article in Outside Magazine about being a reporter who was not embedded during the war in Iraq. And you write in that, war correspondents run terribly high risks, but the truth is that it's safer to take high risks in the company of James Naughtway, a Time photographer, or John Burns, a New York Times reporter, than moderate risks in the company of someone with less experience. Now, as you know, James Naughtway, after you wrote this article, James Naughtway was in a tank in Iraq that he was badly injured. A grenade was thrown into the tank, and a Time magazine.
It was the back of a Humvee.
The
back of a Humvee.
Yeah, thank you for correcting me. And a Time magazine reporter who was in that same Humvee threw out the grenade, but it exploded in his hand, and both the reporter and James Naughtway were injured. And I'm wondering what impact that had on you, since you were using James Nakwe as a barometer of the really savvy war correspondent who so far has been very, you know, up until that point had been safe.
Well, I was in Baghdad when Nakwe was injured, and I visited him at the hospital in the Green Zone the next day. It's a very sobering event, obviously, when any journalist gets injured or killed, and particularly when it's somebody who you've worked with before. It didn't really, and this might sound kind of strange, it didn't really affect me in terms of my awareness or desire to continue doing this kind of stuff, because I've known for a long time just how mortal I am, and that covering a war is an incredibly capricious endeavor. You know, when I covered the war in Bosnia, afterwards I wrote a book about it, and I wrote about how, you know, you can be you know, at the Holiday Inn in Sarajevo, and some new young guy comes in and goes rushing out to the front line foolishly, and you go back up to your room to take a nap. And that young guy can come back from this foolish adventure just fine, and you could have got blown out of your bed by an incoming RPG. So I've been aware, and I don't need to see Jim Nakwe or anybody get injured to understand in the pit of my stomach that anything can happen at any time. And the more dangerous the situation is that I put myself in, the more likely that is to occur, which is why I don't feel comfortable doing these things. I didn't enjoy the time when we were stuck like sitting ducks in Ramadi. I didn't enjoy hearing the gunfire behind us that was aimed at somebody who was shooting at us. You know, yes, I continue to do it, but in controlled doses, and I try to do it as smartly as I can, reducing as many risks as I can, but understanding that I can't reduce them all and that there's a certain amount that is just beyond my control.
Well, Peter Maas, I wish you safe travels. I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Maas's profile of Major John Nagel is the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. Maas is a contributing writer to the magazine. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by Alexander von Schlippenbach, one of the pioneers of the European school of improvised music. This is Fresh Air. German pianist Alexander von Schlippenbach helped establish the European School of Improvised Music that branched off of the free jazz of the 1960s. Schlippenbach's various groups have included the Globe Unity Orchestra and Berlin Jazz Composers Orchestra. He's also arranged music by Jelleroll Morton, Thelonious Monk, and Eric Dolphy for big band. A new Schlippenbach quartet CD includes a pair of Dolphy tunes. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Straight Up and Down by Eric Dolphy. His 1964 version was weird enough, but Alex Schlippenbach's shambling take is a Central European twittering machine out of modernist art as much as modern jazz. Europe's pioneer free improvisers have had an ambivalent relationship with jazz. Its robust grace made them want to improvise too, but some players staked out their own turf by not swinging like Americans. They wanted rolling momentum without anyone having to maintain a steady pulse or consistent texture. Spontaneous rhythmic counterpoint is tricky, and there was lots of trial and error involved, but in the end, they got really good at it. Alexander von Schlippenbach's quartet from the CD Broom Riding on the Psy or PSI label. The drummer is his old colleague Paul Lovens, one of Europe's great percussionists and a master of clattery textures. On cello is the Vermont-born expatriate and instigator Tristan Hansinger. He brought two tunes, including Poetica, where he nudges the free-thinking Germans into a jazzy waltz. Music like this declares old distinctions between jazz and improvised music null and void, on the grounds that it's more fun to play whatever you like than haggle over identity issues. The Eric Dolphy tunes make that point. Dolphy, the open-minded jazz improviser who incidentally died in Berlin in 1964. The other Dolphy tune here is Something Sweet, Something Tender from the same year. Berlin's Rudy Mahal is on bass clarinet, an instrument Dolphy put on the jazz map. The lyricism in that melody is pure Eric Dolphy, though the Schlippenbach Quartet's texture is closer to 20th century chamber music. But then Dolphy played some of that himself, as well as songs by Germany's Kurt Weill and a tribute to the Italian flute virtuoso Severino Gazzoloni. The moral here being, curious musicians will use any good idea, no matter what borders they cross to get at it.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, The Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. He reviewed the new CD, Broom Riding, by German pianist Alexander von Schlippenbach. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive. committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we meet former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind. Suskind's controversial new book, The Price of Loyalty, is about O'Neill's observations of how the Bush administration operates. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.